Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher, 8:06 on this Monday, September 16th. 48 degrees currently here in Old Town Park City under partly cloudy skies. We've got 51 degrees in the Heber Valley. And on the phone with us from the ABC Forecast Center, meteorologist Cedric Haynes. Good morning.
Good morning, Leslie. Yes, we've got a nice, cool, comfortable start to the day. We're starting to see a few clouds out there, but we do expect those clouds to increase as we go throughout today. Today is kind of the calm before the storm, as we like to say, as changes will be underway as we go throughout the next 24 hours. So let's talk about those changes here. Again, those clouds are going to be on the increase for the rest of this afternoon. So we'll call it partly to mostly cloudy skies by later today. There will be a decent chance of scattered showers and storms developing, especially as we get towards 2-3 o'clock this afternoon and beyond. Some of those storms could produce some heavy rain, some gusty winds, and even some small hail. So there is a marginal risk, or what we call a low-end risk, that one or two of those storms could become severe. So we'll be keeping a close eye on that. And of course, we want you to stay weather aware if you're going to be out and about throughout this afternoon, as do know that the weather could go downhill quickly with some of those scattered storms that could be on the severe side. So we'll be watching that closely. Again, the main threats would be some gusty winds and some small hail, of course, along with those brief but heavy downpours that do take place. So once we get past that, the cold front will be approaching the area later this evening and tonight. So I think the chance of rain will actually continue into the overnight hours, and even into your Tuesday, a good chance of showers and thunderstorms. That's as the cold front moves through, especially during the first half of the day. Now, as that front makes its way through, we'll see a good chance of scattered showers and storms with it. But behind the front, that's going to be the bigger story for our friends in Park City. Today, we're looking at high temperatures climbing into the lower 70s. In the Heber Valley today, we're looking at highs climbing into the upper 70s to around 80 degrees. But as we go into your Tuesday, get ready for the big change in temperatures. We're talking highs only in the mid-50s for Park City. Yeah, mid-50s, and highs only in the low to maybe mid-60s across the Heber Valley. So some big changes. It's going to be kind of a shock to the system, especially after this past weekend with those above average temperatures. And then we continue with the unsettled weather through the rest of the week. Wednesday, we may see a lull in the activity, but still, it's going to be a chilly day. Wednesday morning, low temperatures will be down into the 30s in Park City with highs only around 60. And in the Heber Valley, we're talking lows in the 30s with highs in the mid-60s on Wednesday. And then our next storm system arrives on Thursday, bringing us another good chance of scattered showers and storms. And that will keep the below average temperatures in place for the end of the week heading into the weekend with highs only in the 60s and lows in the 30s and 40s. We'll start to dry things out for the weekend. And right now, it looks like the weekend is mostly dry. It's just going to be on the cool side, but it's definitely going to be a fall-like weekend with those temperatures. So make sure you get a chance to get out there and enjoy it. But just know this week will be fairly unsettled, but cooler as well. Leslie.
Okay. Hey, thank you. Well, stay tuned. Coming up on the local news hour this morning, I'll be checking in with PC Reed's event organizer and panel moderator, Carly Driscoll. She'll be joined by Dr. Margie Gillis, who is the featured speaker at an upcoming community literacy event called Raising a Reader. Then Youth Sports Alliance, Heather Sims, and Ashley Locks will have an update on that Youth Sports Award that was received last week. And finally, Park City Recreation Director Ken Fesher in with an update on some recreation issues, including the outdoor pools and that new rec building coming to City Park. Taking a look now at some local news, Park City is actively seeking a development partner for the 5-acre property at the intersection of Bonanza Drive and Kearns Boulevard. KPCW's Parker Malatesta reports the project would transform the city's core.
On Thursday, the city released a request for proposals allowing developers to submit ideas for creating a new mixed-use destination at the center of town. The RFP details Park City's site goals, including affordable housing, commercial space, underground parking, and a new headquarters for the Kimball Arts Center. The city wants some of the retail space to offer reduced rents exclusively for local businesses. Housing should also incorporate a range of unit prices and affordability levels, including deeply affordable housing. The cost, design, and number of units in the project will be up to private developers, who will try to check all the boxes as set forth in the RFP. The proposal further asks for a minimum of 35,000 square feet of community open spaces, including multiple small parks and a large central gathering space for events and concerts. The city wants developers to prioritize public transportation access as well as pedestrian and bicycle pathways. Park City Mayor Nan Worrell said in a press release that the project will lead to a local-centric destination and an affordable place to call home. The city hopes the spotlight of the 2034 Winter Olympics can help draw the attention of elite development teams. In a statement to KPCW, Kimball Arts Center Executive Director Aldi Milliken said the nonprofit is, quote, excited to partner with Park City Municipal to select a visionary developer for this important property in town. Per the RFP, the Kimball Arts Center will get a standalone mixed-use building on just less than an acre. Project plans for a reimagined Bonanza Park have been in the works for nearly a decade. Park City purchased the five-acre parcel for $19 million in 2017, intending to form an arts and culture district, with the Kimball Arts Center and Sundance Institute as core tenants. The concept evolved to also include housing, parking, and a transit center, but the project was put on hold when costs topped the $100 million mark. After hitting the reset button, the city gathered public opinion about the future of the property through online surveys and open houses. The city council used that feedback to work with consultants on an RFP that reflected public support for a mixed-use area with parks, commercial space, and art. The Sundance Institute has not been involved in the second phase of planning for the site, as it considers potentially leaving Utah altogether in 2027. The site is currently zoned as general commercial, which has a building height limit of 35 feet or about three stories. Affordable housing developments can go up to 45 feet, but Park City planners are currently undergoing a full review of the code that governs the entire Bonanza Park neighborhood. And based on the RFP, the city is open to exploring zoning that would achieve community benefits. Submissions from developers are due November 6th. The city plans to conduct interviews in November and begin negotiations with a firm in December. Parker Malatesta, KPCW News.
Coming up on Tuesday, September 24th, PC Reads invites the community to come learn more about raising a reader. In the studio with me, I have the executive director of PC Reads, Alyssa Ayton, along with the event moderator, Carly Driscoll. We're joined by Dr. Margie Gillis on the phone, who is the founder and president of Literacy How Incorporated, which provides professional learning opportunities and coaching for educators. She'll be giving the keynote presentation. So good morning to all of you.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
So Alyssa, let's start with you. Maybe you can just tell us a little bit about what is PC Reads.
Yes. So for those who aren't familiar with our work, we're really a literacy organization in Park City that has direct services to support families of struggling readers. But this event is under our Elevating Literacy program, which really strives to ensure that all parents understand how children learn to read. And so we really are encouraging all, especially parents of younger children, to come to this event.
Okay. The event, Raising a Reader, Carly, will be held when and where?
Yeah, so the event will be held on September 24th at the Blair Education Center from 6 p.m. to 7:30 p.m. Tickets are available on our website. We are charging for this event $10 to ensure people show up for the event, and we are also providing some apps and drinks, and we're a small nonprofit, so we really encourage parents of young children to come out for the event.
Okay, no kids, just the parents.
No kids. We recommend no kids.
Yeah. And why did you want to bring in Dr. Gillis?
So Margie Gillis is the founder of Literacy How, Inc., which provides services to bring a decade of knowledge and research to the classroom. So she focuses on closing the opportunity gap with raising reading achievement for all children. And she works specifically with teachers to help them empower themselves in their classrooms.
All right, so Dr. Gillis, let's bring you into the conversation here. As she mentioned, your business focuses on teaching educators how to teach reading then. Is that right?
That's exactly right, yes.
And how what are some of the strategies that you use then to teach teachers to read?
Oh gosh, there are lots of strategies. Reading is actually quite complex. Learning how to read involves two big things. One, you have to learn how to sound out words or decode them so you know what those words are. But even more importantly, you have to have comprehension of what you're reading. And those are two very different things. So we really unpack how complex reading is and how it can be challenging for children for different reasons. And we unpack that for teachers, sort of more of the theory behind it, so they understand it, how the brain actually has to rewire in order to become a skilled reader. We don't come to the reading, as humans, we have to learn explicitly how to read versus learning how to talk. Our brains are wired naturally for that. So we have to explain that to teachers, and then we have to break it down so that they see all the different pieces that are involved, and then we teach them methods of teaching that content in their classrooms with their students, because teachers really are very concrete. They want to know what it should look like. They want to know what those varying practices are for different skill levels, because in most teachers' classrooms, if they're gen ed teachers, they have a number of different skill levels, and they really have to break it down for those students even more explicitly, those kids who struggle. And so we teach them all of that.
Yeah, so I mean, I learned to read with Dick, Jane, Sally, and Spot. I mean, that was mostly, I think, up front, repetition. I mean, is it any different today? I think for me, the phonics, the decoding came later.
Yeah, no, that's a great point. And many people did, myself included, learned how to read with Dick and Jane, which was more of a sight word method. So you're absolutely right. We had to see those words. You know, some of us could see them 5 times and remember the words. Some of us needed to see them 50 times, some 500 times. Like, that's where the variability comes in. But what we've learned in 50 years of research, we have a lot of research behind this now, what we've learned is that is not the right way to approach teaching reading, that you mentioned phonics, like teaching the students the principles of applying what they know about how letters and sounds go together, and applying that and practicing that so that you become accurate first, and then you become automatic. When you see that word, you don't have to sound it out anymore. You recognize it instantly. But that's not a memorization task. It has more to do with, like I said, applying the principle of the alphabetic code. And because English is an alphabetic language, we have to start there. English is also a challenging language because we have layers in our language that go back, you know, historically. So we have words that are have Latin origins, Greek origins, Anglo-Saxon words. That's something teachers need to understand so that they're not telling kids, oh, English is a crazy language. Don't bother trying to figure that out. Well, actually, it's very logical. There's explanations for 95% of the words and how they're spelled. But teachers need to have that background knowledge in order to explain it to their students. And that's what we do. I have a team of 10 mentors. We go into teachers' classrooms. We have, established a relationship with them. So there's no judgment. It's not, you know, you haven't been doing it right. That's how they learned it. That's how their teacher prep programs prepared them. Now we know a better way. And that's really, the heart of what we do is working with those teachers, also helping them with assessments, because assessments are a big part of this. Like, you really want to have the right assessment that can be administered very quickly, analyzed very quickly, and this is where the kid is, and this is what I need to focus on right now. So those are all parts of the work that we do with teachers.
Yeah, so what do teachers need to be looking for in students who may be struggling with reading?
Well, if they have a risk for dyslexia, one of the red flags for that is a young child who has difficulty with rhyming. And it has to do with how our brains process the sounds of words in words. And if they don't process those sounds easily, that's a red flag. It has nothing to do with intelligence. It really is just, again, how the brain is wired. It's hereditary. So a big question for a parent of a child who they might worry about would be, you know, do you have any history in your family of dyslexia? Some people know they have that and some people don't. I mean, it's still, unfortunately, there are a lot of myths around dyslexia. So part of what I know PC Reads spends a lot of their time doing, and we certainly do this in Connecticut as well, is debunk some of those myths so people understand more about it and are in a better position to help their child. So yeah, I mean, that's a big part of it, really.
I was going to say, I mean, I think it's probably better today than it has been, but dyslexic students wasn't always easy to spot early on, but what we know, the earlier, the better, yeah?
Absolutely, and you can spot it early on. I mean, you can spot it with a three-year-old. You can spot it because dyslexia is a language-based learning disability, which means that it impacts language in different ways. So I just explain that a child might have trouble, you know, hearing the sounds, you know, a rhyming word, or hearing the sounds in a word and spelling, being able to spell that word based on the sounds, right? But it could also impact other aspects of language. Like, there's a fairly high percentage of children with dyslexia who are late talkers, or who have speech difficulties articulating the sounds. It's not always the case, but again, it may be another red flag. They also could get confused in how they say a multisyllabic word like spaghetti. They could say pischetti. Now, that's a common thing for a young child, a two-year-old. But if they persist with that type of behavior, just another red flag. Another flag is not being able to retain information, right? So you've seen the letters in your home from the time you were a baby, and they're on the refrigerator, right? And your mom and dad and whoever is with you reads to you, and they're still not retaining the names of those letters or the sounds of those letters or the days of the week in a specific order. Like, there's certain red flags. You can find those red flag checklists, but you can spot these kids pretty early. And actually, because dyslexia is a neurobiological disorder, we can see it in the brain. And so there's lots of research out there where babies are going into, fMRI scans and seeing, or not MRI scans, I should say, and we can see their brains are looking different than the typical developing child. So those things are happening just to advance our understanding of the research, because it is extremely important to find these kids who are at risk early. We're not identifying dyslexia until a child is starting to learn to read. You can't, because it has to do with reading. But what we can say is this child may be at risk. And if we can find those children, you know, in preschool programs, ideally, then we can be playing with language and having fun, not didactic kill and drill or drill and kill or whatever you want to call it, but having fun with language and really exposing children so that they can, you know, have a lot of experiences that will set them up for success later on when they do learn to read. And there's lots of good research on that early intervention.
How often? Makes a big difference. How often is it a matter of just having poor eyesight?
You know, a lot of people, unfortunately, I talked about myths. That's one of them, that dyslexia is a visual processing disorder because many children reverse the letters, right? They write them backwards, numbers too. Sometimes they write a whole word backwards, or they'll start writing their name on the right side of the page and instead of going left to right. Those are all very common developmental things that happen with young children. So that's not one flag that you want to really notice or pay too much attention to. Unless a child is still reversing after the age of 7, then that might be considered a red flag. But dyslexia is not a visual processing disorder. The American Medical Association and Pediatrics have released statements about that, because that is still very, very commonly held misconception about dyslexia, and we really want to make sure that we dispel that myth. I will say that there are some children who are dyslexic and have difficulty with visual spatial processing. So I'm not saying that you might not have that, or you never have that. That is a common thing. Or not a common thing, I should say, but it does happen. But what we don't want parents looking for a quick fix, like going to an ophthalmologist and doing visual exercises, and then spending a lot of money and being very disappointed when they find out that that didn't help the child learn to read. Maybe it helps with the visual spatial issues. That could be the case, but that's not going to teach the child to read. And that's what we really want parents and teachers too. But, you know, we want to make sure that parents are getting accurate information, because there is a plethora of research out there on dyslexia and other learning disabilities and on how to teach children to read. And that's something that, you know, certainly I and my nonprofit organization, Literacy How, have been focused on for, you know, 15 years in that work, and then before that working in a research lab.
All right, well, let's talk briefly just about the impact that screens have had on children learning to read.
Oh, they've had such a big impact on the screeners are a lifesaver, really, because, as I said before, we have a lot of research on what the warning signs are, what the flags are, and these screeners are designed to be reliable and valid, which means that you give them the same way and you should get reliable and valid results if they're administered correctly. They're designed to be fast, so they might take anywhere from, you know, 10 minutes to 20, 25 minutes, depending on the length. Some apps, there's an early bird screener, which is now pretty commonly used, that was developed at Mass General. Nadine Gobb and her colleagues, Boston Children's Hospital. It's amazing app for young children and 3, 4, 5, and I think it's all the way up now through second grade. So there's the Dibbles that's been around for years. These screeners are phenomenal because they're designed, like I said, to find these kids early. They're also great because they are used 3 times a year, so you can chart progress toward the benchmark goals. Many of them also have built in what are called probes that can be administered fairly regularly to see if the student is making progress, which is really important because, you know, you start with a, you know, with a piece of or some data. You say, okay, these are the things that seem to be a problem for the student. I'm going to apply this method of instruction or this program. You go along for a while, you know, a month, and the child's not making any progress, and you know that because you can administer these little probes. It's like taking somebody's temperature, right? And we know now, you know, how to administer those, how to use those to guide instruction, and that's part of a comprehensive assessment plan. So, again, it's really important that we're looking at that, because sometimes what happens is a child goes into what's called an intervention for a learning disability and or a reading problem, and they stay in that intervention for months, and all of a sudden, you know, the parent says, well, I don't think they're making any progress, you know, what's happening? And the teacher will say, well, you know, she's making some progress, but it's very subjective, there's no objective data. And that's the point of these assessments, is to get the information as quickly as possible, because if that instruction's not working, then obviously we don't want to keep using it. Now we have to go back and do more what we call diagnostic testing to look more deeply at what's going on, and then course correct, find a method that is more suited to the student's profile.
Okay.
And that,
I guess I was going to make the point, though, that it's a double-edged sword here, because we've got these digital devices that are taking kids away from books.
In terms of the screen, you know, the screeners, you mean?
I'm talking about actual screens where they've got an iPad in front of them.
Oh, I'm so sorry.
Yeah,
I thought you were talking about screening.
Yeah.
Oh,
no.
I went down another path. Sorry.
Yeah, you
about
did.
That.
Okay, but I've got to move on. So, Carly, I want to talk to you. You're going to be moderating a panel afterwards. Who's going to be joining you?
Yeah, thanks. After Margie wraps up her keynote, where she's going to educate us on how children learn how to read, we're going to host a community panel that will include Britta Jocelyn from the Park City Day School, Elizabeth Phillips from Weilemann School of Discovery. She's the lower school principal. And then two Women from Park City School District, Katie McGinn, who is our literacy specialist here, and Amy Jenkins, who is the director of elementary. We will also be bringing in a world-renowned reading educator, Dr. Louisa Motes, who wrote the Letters Program, which all of our K through third grade teachers have just completed that program. We're going to be talking about the district's decisions on the new curricula that they're bringing into the Park City School District. Wylaman School of Discovery is already using this curriculum. And then the day school also uses a very well researched, backed by science of reading program as well.
Okay, people do need to register?
Yes, we really highly encourage the parents of the community to come out for this and register ahead of time. We will be marketing this on social media, follow our Instagram page, join our email list, and please come out to learn more about how your children are learning how to read.
Okay, sounds like an action-packed 90 minutes.
Yes.
Okay, anything else?
No, thank you so much, Margie, for joining us today, and thanks, Leslie, for having us. We really appreciate it.
Yes, thank you. Thank you very much. Enjoyed talking with you all.
Okay, thanks. Again, that's Dr. Margie Gillis. She's the featured speaker at a community literacy event September 24th titled Raising a Reader. You'll need to register for that, pcreads.org. Also, we had Carly Driscoll and Alyssa Eaton. Thanks so much for your time.
Thank you.
In studio now, I have Youth Sports Alliance Programs Director Heather Sims, joined by Youth Sports Alliance Development Director Ashley Lasko. Good morning to both of you. Thanks for being with us.
Good morning. Hi, good morning, Leslie.
Heather, let's start with you. The news that came out late last week that YSA was honored with a national award. Tell us about that.
Yes, I was lucky enough to go to Washington, D.C. on behalf of the Youth Sports Alliance. We won the President's Council on Sports, Fitness, and Nutrition for the Community Leadership Award. We were one of 100 nominees and one of 20 that actually received the award. And it honors organizations that contribution to the well-being of their communities by promoting physical activity, sports, and nutrition while supporting the potential of all community members. So it was definitely a huge honor, and truly I felt so proud to be there and represent the Youth Sports Alliance.
Yeah, so how were you nominated?
It was basically an application, and then you kind of, they have a council that reviews every application, and some of the people that are on the counter on the council are Steph Curry and Chloe Kim. So it was really a great honor for the Youth Sports Alliance.
Yeah, anything in particular from the YSA programming that they singled out or noted?
So I think it's basically the growth of the programs over the years, and specifically out in our more rural areas like South Summit and North Summit. And, you know, over the last 10 years, we've grown from 800 kids to 2,500 kids in the programs. So we're definitely doing something right and getting kids off their screens and, you know, being more active in the community.
Okay, well, congratulations for
Thank
that.
You.
Any money with that, or was it just notoriety?
It is just notoriety, but it's definitely an honor. And yes, it was no money, I'm afraid, but it was just a real honor. And now we can put our president's badge on our website. And so it's a truly great feeling to be part of that community now.
Yeah, and we think about, you know, I mean, a lot of the programs are physical activity, getting outdoors and biking or skiing or...
Right, right.
But nutrition was also part of that. Is that just because of the cooking classes that you offer?
Well, there was... we do offer nutrition, but our whole program is obviously to get people more active, healthier. I feel like Utah is a little anomaly, and especially Park City, and the people are very aware of their fitness and nutrition. And so as we expand our programs out, I think we need to be very aware of that and bring in the nutrition classes and, you know, the cooking classes.
Okay, you do have your programs underway. Tell us about what's going on.
Yeah, this week we just finished a week with 325 kids on the Wasatch Back doing all things from sailing to woodwood to triathlon. So lots and lots of programs out in the Wasatch Back. We are in Heber. Our Heber programs are on Mondays, and our South Summit and Park City programs are on Fridays, and it's a full rack of programs. So there's something for everyone from first grade all the way through to 12th. Our sailing programs, we've got some juniors in that, and then obviously we've got first graders doing triathlons. So we have something for everybody.
Okay. So are those just the 2 days that you do, Mondays and Fridays?
Yeah, so we do always try and do early after school, when the school gets out early. We do have a couple of odd classes sometimes in the week, just based on when those venues can come out. So right now we have a couple of Tuesdays where Woodward actually go out and do some outreach in Wasatch Back. So, and then we always have the question of when are the ski programs opening, and those will be mid-October. So just waiting on a few details from the resorts.
Okay. People can go have a look at ysausa.org.
Yes.
All right. Coming up Thursday at the Santee Auditorium, you've got a special screening happening here. Tell us about that.
Yes. We're working with the Park City Film Institute and Akwasi Frimpong, who is a skeleton athlete. And we're doing a special viewing of the film Black Ice, followed by a panel discussion for the power of sport and how it changes lives. Akwasi made history in the 2018 Winter Olympics as the first black male skeleton Olympian. And the film showcases his 17-year journey of perseverance, resilience, and breaking barriers. The event is at the Park City Library, and on Thursday, September 19th at 7 p.m. Tickets are free for students and $10 for adults, and you can purchase those tickets at parkcityfilm.org. I personally have seen the film. It's kind of like a Marvel type program, and so it is absolutely for the whole family. He's a very gregarious, optimistic personality, and I can absolutely recommend it as a family event. So please come out and see that on Thursday.
Okay, people do need to get a ticket though.
They do.
ParkCityFilm.org. And then there's going to be a panel after the screening, and you're going to bring some of the YSA athletes. Who are you going to have join you?
Yes, so we have Kate Presgrove. She's a figure skater. She's also one of the students that went out to Paris for the Olympics. And then we have Maddie Kaiserman, who's a skier, and then Emily Fisher, our executive director, and then as well as Akwasi and Tom Kelly will be moderating. So it's really about their journeys and how sport has made an impact into their lives, and just this, you know, they've had to persevere, and really how it's sport changes. Sport changes your lives.
Mm-hmm. And so what are their particular barriers that they've broken? I mean, in terms of their having to persevere?
Well, definitely there's been injuries along the way, but also the financial barriers. We know that as you start to gain your way into the national stage, you know, that especially the travel, there's been a lot of financial barriers. And so they, you know, there are some personal barriers too. And so we're just kind of bringing that out in them and just kind of talking about what it really has meant to them, and showcasing how sport really has an impact on your life.
All right, let's see, Ashley, we've got Jan's Winter Welcome next month. It did sell out.
Yes, we are really excited about the 44th annual Jan's Winter Welcome that's scheduled for Saturday, October 26th, up at Stein Erickson Lodge. It is correct, we are sold out, but we have a wait list started for admission, and we typically do have some movement on that. Tickets do become available. So please reach out to me directly. You can reach me at ashley@ysausa.org. So please connect with me if you're interested in getting on that wait list. But we do have other ways to be involved with the event too. We're selling tickets for our opportunity drawing package. The winning prize is a trip to Belize. And this year that prize includes a week stay in a new 5-bedroom, 6-bath oceanfront house with a pool. It also includes a $4,000 flight credit. So that'll help you get down to Belize. There's a few nights with a private chef included and daily housekeeping. So it can really be used in a lot of different ways for a family, for a vacation, of couples, a reunion. We're really excited about the package this year.
All right. Let's see. Years ago, you used to, and this is certainly before your time, but you did used to open it up, I think, to other members of the community. They could buy a kind of an after party ticket. Are you doing that anymore?
We don't have that now, no. We really, we have the event on Saturday. The other ways to be involved are by participating in the opportunity drawing. Our silent auction also goes live a few days before the event. So that used to be something that was just available to guests, but now that's open online to everybody. So the silent auction will go live on Wednesday, October 23rd. So visit our website, please, to find that link. That is another great way for community members who aren't attending to be involved.
Okay, this is a big fundraiser for you guys. How much are you hoping to raise?
It is. Last year, we were really pleased to help our partner teams raise over $300,000 through the auction, through the opportunity drawings. And then in the event, we also raised over $200,000 for need-based training and travel scholarships that went directly to our athletes on our partner teams through the Stein Erickson Endowment. So we are excited to hopefully beat those numbers this year.
Okay. Anything else you want to mention?
But if you want more information about programs or the Jans Winter Welcome, please go to ysausa.org and please join us on Thursday for at the Park City Film Series, and that tickets are at parkcityfilm.org.
Okay, Ashley and Heather, thanks so much for your time.
Great. Thanks, Leslie.
Thank you.
Joining me now in the studio with an update from Park City Recreation, I have Recreation Director Ken Fisher. Good morning, Ken.
Morning, Leslie.
So with kids back in school, I'm thinking pool playtime winding down at the Mark. Does that mean construction is underway there for the pools, or what's going on there?
Yeah, so we were hoping to start this fall, but we're going to push that to the spring, and really that has to do with some finalized pool design as well as the cost of mobilizing construction firm, then having them leave for a few months and then come back. So our target is to get that project out to bid right around the first of the year and then start as soon as I can, hopefully in April.
Okay, so what is the design at this point?
Well, we're going to increase the lap pool. It's going to go from 6 to 8 lanes. So that's a significant change for us, and hopefully will be well received by the community. And then the leisure pool will have a zero entry. So instead of, starting at about a foot and a half deep, you'll be able to walk right in. We'll have a large zero entry area, a little play feature there. We'll have a slide, climbing wall, and then an area we call the chicken fight area, where older kids will be able to play in.
Okay, and then on the lap pool, what's the length of the pool?
25 yards.
Okay, you don't do meters, huh?
No, 25 yards.
Okay, and so what have you got budgeted for the two pools?
So we have a $7.5 million budgeted. So hopefully that will cover it. There are RAP tax grants that are available now, and we'll be putting in for some RAP tax money also for the pool.
Okay. And then in terms of the timeline, if they start, they're going to do both pools at once, or are you going to just shut it down for next summer?
So we will have the nice thing about relocating both pools down by the area where the current lap pool is, that we'll be able to keep the leisure pool operational next summer. So that's our plan. In terms of lap swimming, that's something that we'll be working on through the winter to see if it's possible for us to partner with some other organizations.
All right. And is the lap pool open for the winter?
It will be open through the end of October at this point. And we would keep it open longer if we had lifeguards. So really, anyone out there that may be a lifeguard or is an avid swimmer that is willing to put some hours in, I encourage you to reach out to Heather Todd.
Okay. Speaking of pools, how did the cardboard boat race go Saturday? Anyone make it across?
Oh, yeah. We had eight teams, and I guess they got two laps in. So two heats, and the winner was the Silver Bullet. So that's a fun event, and we've been doing that, I think, for 3-4 years now. Participation was down a little bit this year, but hopefully that will rebound next year. And then the next event that we have that's real popular along those lines is we do one in the winter for the sled derby, cardboard sled derby out at the ice arena.
Okay. Let's talk a little bit about the City Park Rec building. Do we have final designs there?
Working on that still. We go to Planning Commission next Wednesday, the 25th of September, for a work session. So we've got all our paperwork in and, you know, all our applications filed and all that. So a lot of that will depend on how that work session goes. But hopefully we would be able to get back to the Planning Commission in December, January, get that project out to bid shortly after that. And then the timeline for that is to start construction right at the end of next summer, right when the kids go back.
Okay, so you got some big projects happening in 1 year then.
Yeah, right, we're busy.
Well, that construction that go through the winter, you think?
It would, certainly, it would go start in the fall, and then it would be done the winter of 26, 27.
Yeah, so it'd be open in time for summer camp, the 26.
Well, we would lose one summer of day camp at the City Park. Will be under construction, you know, all of that summer. So again, we'll be coming up with plans to relocate that camp. We'll certainly keep it operational, and I would imagine we would potentially run it out of the Mark, work with the ice arena, potentially the school district, whatever we do. But that's a key program for us to keep operational.
Okay. Let's see, the rec department also oversees the Park City Cemetery. Have you figured out how to add more plots there? I think you're just about out of room.
Well, we are out of room for full casket burials. We have no plots left for sale. It's not filled, so that just means that people own them and you know, waiting to use them. We did do a expansion of the cemetery related to the cremation garden, and that happened all around the gazebo there. And that was, it's a great project. We've added about 70 spots, and it's a variety of products that people can buy. And again, that's just for Park City residents to use it. If you're a non-resident, we do have the memorial wall that's there. That's not a burial option, but it's a place where people could put a plaque to memorialize a loved one.
So is there any talk, though, about going up Boot Hill there?
You know, we looked at that, and there's a lot of rock up there, so it's very difficult to do. So at this point, we're going to stick with the cremation garden, and then we'll see if there's potential to... you know, Snyderville Basin's looking at a cemetery. Maybe there's an option for the city to partner with them out there.
Okay. Let's see. The rec department has also implemented early registration for city residents in programs 48 hours before opening them to everyone else. Are we specifically talking summer camp here?
No, this is for all our programs across the board. So as you alluded to, the past few years, we have done early registration for our summer day camp. And we do that for Park City residents, as well as those that may work here in 84060. This is really just for city residents, and they get an advance 48 hours to register for any of our programs, and then it will open up to the rest of the community. And this was really, you know, a priority for City Council, again, prioritizing Park City residents for some of our programs that, you know, sell out quickly.
Yeah, so what are some of those other programs? Are we talking about, like, youth soccer and basketball and things like that, or?
Yeah, no, I think all the leagues will be fine. Really, where we've seen it is in our tennis program. We have a red ball tennis where it's been selling out very quickly. And actually, this registration period, we implemented that early registration for 84060, And it was a significant change where most of the participants were Park City residents.
Okay. And you said that was directed by City Council then, huh?
Yeah, City Council.
They had just gotten, a lot of complaints saying, I can't get in?
Yeah, right. They get some complaints. And I think it's been a priority for them to prioritize city residents. And this is a way they could do that. Certainly our facility and the Recreation Department is supported by the Park City taxpayer. So they're looking for ways to add some value to residents.
Okay. You got a new bubble.
Yeah, new bubble going in this week. Hope the weather is going to hold out for us, but it's exciting. That will be up. Oh, we've closed the courts for about a week because it takes a little more work to get that first bubble up as we get new lights, new doors, new bubble. So it's exciting for us.
Okay, and then that'll stay up, through April?
Yeah, we usually get that down around the first week of May.
All right. And is it larger than it was, or is it still, we're still talking the same number of court space?
Yeah, same number of courts. Covers the three courts, three tennis courts, the six pickleball courts, where it's always been. It'll be a little bit different shape just because it's different manufacturer and it's new, but it should really improve the quality of play out there with a nice new white bubble.
Okay, and we haven't heard much from the pickleballers. Have you finally figured out how to schedule them all?
Oh, boy, we're working on that, and we're never going to get it. So we have a schedule that's going to make everyone happy. But we are working to give them some more time in the mornings and in the afternoons this coming winter. We put together a court allocation subcommittee that was made up of pickleball players, tennis players, rec board members, and they've come up with a plan that we're in the process of getting that information out and implementing.
Okay, so if court space isn't filled, say, by the time during tennis, will you open it to pickleball, or it's really only tennis only?
No, we will switch it back and forth. So it's similar to last year, twice a week we go in and we look at the court sheets, and if the courts aren't being used by, if it's tennis time, and they're not being used by tennis, we will release those to pickleball. And that goes from, it's about a 24 to I think 100 and some odd hour advance notice people will get. And it would be the same the other way. If we have it as dedicated pickleball time and it's not filled by pickleball, we'll turn it back to tennis.
All right, so people need to just see, they can see that online when they kind of go to book, or?
Yeah, when they go to our court reservation system, they'll be able to see whether it's tennis or pickleball and just be able to book a court.
Okay, but we're not doing both sports at the same time.
No, we're not. And some of that is obviously the noise factor. We may try it later this winter since we are giving pickleball some more time in the bubble. We just want to see, where the tennis players end up going. And if we find that there's a time where only one or two courts are being used consistently, we may just open that up in advance for side-by-side play.
All right, and then any future plans then for pickleball courts? Because he had talked about maybe building some out at Quinn's.
Yeah, we have, we had an RFP out for a public-private partnership for an indoor pickleball facility. We're still, working through that selection process. And hopefully we'll have some news on that in a couple of weeks with a preferred vendor.
Okay, and any news with the ice arena repair work that you've been doing or anything there?
No, I think the ice arena is going on. I will say I played hockey last night, so it's ice is in great shape and continues to be booming. I know their programs are bursting at the seams. Again, with the Utah Hockey Club coming, it's really driven the desire for people to get out and play. So it's interesting to see.
Okay. What do they get the best times? Or are they there at 5 a.m.?
The Utah Hockey Club?
Yeah.
Yeah, no, they're not there. But, I mean, just them coming to to Utah, right, it really sparks interest. Similar to when, whenever the Olympic year, we always see a boost. But, no, there's, as an adult, right, I played last night at 10:15.
Okay. Ken, anything else you want to mention?
No, that's it. Thanks, Leslie.
All right. Ken Fisher is the recreation director for Park City Municipal.